Our second case for this morning is Jones against Burge. And when we have everybody settled, we'll start with Mr. Henderson. Oh, there's a button underneath. You want to help him? There we go. And just press it when you have it as high as you want.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Victor Henderson, on behalf of Melvin Jones, Al Burton, Aubrey Dungy, James Freeman, and Sherrod Tillis.
I have a preliminary question for you, Mr. Henderson. I'm not sure how reliable this is, but there's at least one blog or website that suggests that Mr. Jones died earlier this year.
Your Honor, he did die.
And is there any estate or any entity now representing him?
The estate is in the process of being put together. It's a family of modest means, so Mr. Jones did in fact die, and the family is in the process of attempting to create an estate there of modest means, so that is an ongoing process.
Okay.
My recollection, a vague one, is that the rules create a time limit for substitution. I'm a little surprised that you haven't alerted the court, but if my memory is correct, that time is doubtless ticking.
Has a suggestion of death been filed by your opponents?
Your Honor, again, we've been working with the family. Mr. Jones was homeless, and so it's been difficult to reach his family. So when we hear from them, we're not able to reach them. They know that they were to do that. We were working with them to get that done.
Right. It would have been a good thing for you simply to have filed a suggestion of death with the court so that we wouldn't have had to poke around on websites to find this. But perhaps you can henceforth keep us up to date with what's happening so that we can assess timeliness or whatever else needs to be done.
Yes, Your Honor. With respect to the case, our focus is on the dismissal by the district court of the complaint, primarily focusing on an issue of equitable estoppel, equitable tolling, and continuous violation. The background for the case is that, as you know, the criminal justice system over 26 in California, for all practical purposes, had broken down on behalf of the plaintiffs. There are allegations in the complaint that the police were engaged in unlawful conduct, that the prosecutors going up to the highest level, including the state's attorney himself, who were involved in inappropriate activity, and that the inactivity of the police and the prosecutors eventually infected the judicial system over at 26 in California, because some of the prosecutors then were becoming judges.
So here's the problem. I mean, of course, we are quite familiar with this unfortunate story of Area 2 and then Area 3. But the period during which it was broken came to an end at some point, and there's been now for many years a lot of litigation. It's my recollection that Mr. Jones himself testified in one of the cases. And if we are in the realm of equity, from the realm of equitable tolling in particular, there's still a diligence requirement. So if, as of, just to pick a random number, the early 2000s, this general story was basically known about the breakdown of the police, the courts, everything else, I'm having trouble seeing how we can find the necessary diligence to overcome the limitations period.
Well, Your Honor, I have two responses to that. First and foremost, I don't think that the system is repaired. The system is still broken because there's still people who are stuck in the pipeline who can't get through the system. So the system doesn't repair itself like a light switch, whereas one day it's broken and one day it's fixed. Rather, we believe that the system is in a slow repair, so in many respects for the people that we're representing, the system is still broken.
But you're essentially arguing, I think, that the state of Illinois should amend its statute of limitations and make torture something like murder so that there just isn't a limitations period on it. I know bills to that effect have been introduced. They haven't passed yet. And, you know, instead Illinois created this commission that I suppose is looking into. I don't know whether your clients are participating in the procedures there. Okay. But there are still limitations periods, and it's, you know, our responsibility to apply them even if things aren't perfect yet.
Well, Your Honor, I think the response to that is twofold. Number one, you're right. There have been unsuccessful attempts in the legislature in order to, in effect, get rid of the statute of limitations for abuse, like there is no statute of limitation for murder. And there are other countries that say there should not be a statute of limitations for abuse, and that, therefore, those crimes should be able to be prosecuted in perpetuity. The difference here is that when the legislature is also broken and when a certain aspect of the criminal justice system is broken, the only place that the litigants have to turn is this courtroom. And the reason why the reason why the litigants are here is that the way the founders and the framers set the government up is that there is sometime only one place where you can go for relief, and that's here. The legislators, for their own reasons, don't want to change the law. We found ourselves in a situation where the court system was broken from top to bottom over at 26 in California, and so therefore, when human beings and individuals have rights, and we're asking you to equitably toll, it's by virtue of the fact that this is the only place where you can get relief for a system that was and still is in many respects broken. And
of course,
so
we're not really talking about 26th and California exclusively, because you've made a strong argument that at least for some of your clients, the type of case that you're bringing is not one that would necessarily undermine the validity of a conviction. A conviction, just as in the Fourth Amendment, a conviction can still be a good conviction even if there was a Fourth Amendment violation. I thought your position was even if there had been torture, that's a completely unacceptable tactic, but maybe there is evidence that would support a conviction. Otherwise, you're stuck with heck.
No, Your Honor, that is right, because torture, whether they are guilty or not, is not something that becomes, and they should be able to have a right to sue. Secondarily, in terms of the due diligence, the city argues that these crimes against them, the torture committed, you know, 15, 20 years ago, but our clients did not have an opportunity to get into court to have those crimes considered. So just because you have the right to go to court doesn't mean that once you get to court, the system is working properly. So therefore, in effect, they had a hollow right.
I thought some people have, however, filed civil lawsuits against the responsible parties. There have been a number of settlements in these cases. So why doesn't that suggest that some action could have been taken?
Well, it doesn't suggest it, Your Honor, because what we determined, we looked at the approximately 135 victims, and of those 135 victims, only two of them filed a claim within the statute of limitations period for torture. The other 133 approximately did not. And so when you look at it from a systemic basis,
those claims were highly publicized, though.
Well, but all of the people, yes, they were highly publicized, but of the people who were successful in having suits, it was all after they had been determined that they had been wrongfully convicted. And so, therefore, they did not file their claims and receive significant sums of money until after they were wrongfully convicted. And again, that's approximately only 20 out of 135. So from a percentage standpoint, less than 20% of the people were able to get through the system, and only two of the 135 got through timely filing a claim for torture within the 2-year period. So for all practical purposes, none of the 135 victims other than the two were able to file a claim for torture within the 2-year period. So the system didn't work for anybody. And so in terms of the due diligence that you speak to, it wasn't until the federal government undertook the Burge case for perjury, which, and I want to highlight the fact that as we stand here now, not one police officer has been convicted for the torture itself from a criminal perspective. And so the system, in effect, wasn't working for these particular people that we represent.
Well, that again was limitations, as I recall. I mean, there was a big commission that looked into all of this, and it concluded that there had been terrible acts, but it also concluded that the statute of limitations had run, except that Mr. Burge was foolish enough to perjure himself in the proceedings before that commission, which created, of course, a new crime, and he was prosecuted for that.
And so as soon as he was prosecuted, then the people realized that the federal court system might be an avenue within which to seek redress for the torture.
Why they drew that inference, though, since the reason the perjury prosecution was timely was because the perjury was new. It wasn't the old torture. And so you're really here, in a sense, on a new theory. And I, just as Judge Tinder does, I recall, for a long time now, there's been a lot of publicity about this. And, you know, so you've got the issue of separating your claim from anything that would undermine a conviction, because I take it you agree that if it would undermine the conviction, heck means, just as some people did, you've got to wait for exoneration. You've also got to show enough diligence that at least you can get to the next step. Obviously, statute of limitations is an affirmative defense, and if there is some chance of showing diligence, then maybe it was precipitous to dismiss on 12b-6 as opposed to waiting for a later stage. But if the facts just show too much time, no matter what, then perhaps 12b-6 was acceptable.
Well, there are two responses to the diligence argument, Your Honor. First and foremost, all of our clients and the 135 people that we profess to represent were diligent because they're raising these claims from day one. They're screaming, they're hollering from the rooftops that these things are happening. The issue is that either A, no one believed them, or B, even worse, once they were believed, the system did not move forward to make their claim credible, or to, in other words, to give them relief in the court system. So they did. No one's been sitting on their rights. The defendants know that this is the position of these particular claimants from day one. There's no surprise. They know, and part of the reason for the statute of limitations is to prevent the defendants from having to deal with a claim that's old, that's stale, that's going to surprise them. And in this particular case, that's not the case because they've been yelling from the rooftops that there's been torture from day one.
So would you describe a little bit the your answer makes me think about your conspiracy theory. What exactly is the conspiracy that you are trying to point to?
Well, the conspiracy has two elements. First and foremost is the conspiracy that there's a conspiracy of silence. You have all these people running around the city of Chicago who know what transpired, who know that they tortured people.
So is this a conspiracy to obstruct justice? I mean, I want silence in and of itself doesn't mean too much to me. You know, how that conspiracy has an illegal object, I guess, is what I'm looking
for. The conspiracy prevents or makes it extraordinarily difficult for the claimants to move forward with their claim from a practical perspective, when you have the choice between listening to a poor black person who's been accused of murder or a well-placed policeman, then you know, the police knew that they would be believed and that the poor people would not be believed. And so diligence has to be viewed in the context of, you know, them being in the system and knowing that they are on the fringes of the system. So diligence for a well-placed party that has access to the judicial system unencumbered is different than access for someone who sits on the fringes that either A, no one wants to believe, or B, once they believe them, don't want to help them. And that's exactly what transpired here. You have people who are in the system who are saying that, yes, this happened, and people are like, oh, well, you know, there's nothing we're going to do about it, or alternatively, or even worse, work against them to keep them from getting the information that they needed to present their claims.
So what's the illegal object? Where's the legal violation in this conspiracy?
The violation relates to the underlying torture and the fact that all of these individuals allege that on one level or another they were tortured.
Is it because the police had some obligation to come forward and talk about the torture? Is it because they lied before juries? I'm trying to get concrete about this. I'm trying not to just stay in the ghastly things happen realm, which
they lied in reports. They lied in court. The prosecutors, the allegations that the prosecutors cooperated with the police in enabling them to lie, and that then the judges turned their head to the lies, thereby depriving claimants or the plaintiffs of an opportunity to prove their case and also to be able to prove that they were tortured. And the conspiracy continues today. The last overt act of the conspiracy, of course, is the letter that we say that was submitted by William Kunkel to say that, in fact, this conspiracy or that the torture, in fact, did not exist when, in fact, it did. And then, and as I've indicated, the last continuing act, at least from an overt way as opposed to a covert way, was the letter from William Kunkel in 2010, and then the plaintiffs were diligent and right after came in and filed suit. So if there are no further questions, I'll reserve my time.
Okay, that sounds fine. Mr. Henriquez.
May it please the court, all the federal claims of all five named plaintiffs are barred by the applicable limitations period or by Heck v. Humphrey.
Now, I don't see, in order to say that there's a Heck bar, I guess you have to see this as exclusively a false confession. If that's what it was, then I don't have any problem with a Heck bar. But I don't see why, if somebody's tortured, but it just so happens that the police have tortured the right person, so to speak, and there are videos and all sorts of eyewitnesses and DNA evidence and everything else in the world that is presented at the prosecution of that person for the crime concerned, then I don't see why the existence of the torture affects necessarily, in the way that Heck talks about it, the validity of the conviction.
We agree with you, Your Honor.
That means those cases would have to fall in your statute of limitations theory, not in your Heck theory.
Correct. The only claims that we say are Heck barred are the due process claims, the claims that contend that the trial was unfair, that accrued the moment the conviction came down, and therefore there was no accrual of those claims. They never accrued because under the Wallace decision, those claims were heck barred from the moment the convictions were entered they impugned the conviction.
So those claims may still be out there if these convictions, for everyone except Jones, are ultimately overturned.
That's correct, Your Honor. Those claims are still potentially live if the convictions are ever overturned, but only the due process.
So if there's a long-term conspiracy to commit perjury in every criminal trial arising out of Area 2 or some such thing, it would be your position that somehow or another that perjury needs to be shown in a collateral proceeding that's brought to set aside the conviction first before any claim for damages could go forward.
On the due process claims.
Right.
The other claims did accrue from the moment that the alleged torture, race discrimination occurred, and with respect to the coerced self-incrimination claims, they accrued from the moment that evidence of the coerced confession, the allegedly coerced confession, was admitted during the criminal case.
So here's the problem with, I mean, there are a couple of problems with that. One of them is, you know, if you happen to like history and you go back to the purpose of the 14th Amendment, it seems to be targeted at precisely the kind of thing that went on here, physical abuse of African Americans by state officials under circumstances where the state courts are simply not open for redress. So that's one thing that worries me. The second thing that worries me is, in fact, the idea that maybe you know that there was torture, but if there's a widespread conspiracy, as I would say, to obstruct justice in the civil justice system, a widespread conspiracy to lie, you can make sure, you can just keep lying for 2 years. Now the statute of limitations has run, and you're done. You can prevent the claims from ever being brought. So that doesn't strike me as very satisfactory as an outcome. It rewards dishonesty. This court mentioned very recently in the Rivera case that the entire judicial system rests on the proposition that people have to be honest with the courts. That's true in the state courts as well as the federal courts. So there are very troublesome things about your theory.
Well, no one has ever argued that the federal courts were blind to any alleged justice of any sort. The federal courts were clearly always open, no matter what was the no matter what alleged problems were happening in the state criminal system. There's never been an allegation that the federal district courts or this court were a part of the problem, and there was no reason why any of these plaintiffs should have waited to file their claims in this court.
So what do you think should have happened in the following scenario? Suppose, you know, maybe it's 1993. A lot has come out by that time. The Burge is gone. There's been an investigation by the Chicago police. So it's 1993, and Mr. Jones hypothetically files this case. He files a 1983 action for the torture, and it goes forward, and there's a trial, and every single witness for the police lies on the stand, and so he loses his case. He takes his appeals. The evidence is the evidence. Nobody knows. You know, you have to defer to jury credibility findings, and so it's over. And now he tries to come back, but of course he has res judicata facing him as a strong rule that it can't be revisited. So again, it's like lying works is the message I take from that.
Well, that's all speculative. We have no idea that that would happen. That's supposition that that could have happened. The nothing prevented them. The equitable tolling doctrine.
I thought they're one of the people did actually bring a case and lost and tried to bring again, and it was barred by res judicata. Burton, yeah.
No, Burton brought his claim, and it was late. He's brought three claims. This is his third time.
Right.
His first claim was dismissed as time limited already. He then brought another claim that was dismissed again as both time-limited and res judicata. And, of course, he joins this action, and our position is that it is time-limited and barred by res judicata as well. So he was the only person. But the doctrine of equity.
But in my hypothetical, I mean, I know you want to say that this wouldn't have happened, but the allegation here is there was a widespread conspiracy among the police to commit perjury, to conceal these completely illegal acts that they were engaged in these two different police offices. And so I am concerned that if somebody had tried and the conspiracy was holding and they all commit perjury, I don't know what we do about that. We just say, oh, well, life is hard, or?
Well, the doctrine of equitable tolling, as it has been developed, requires that the plaintiff be prevented from bringing an action, not just that they choose to bring an action because of a belief, no matter how firmly held, that they wouldn't be able to succeed. They still have to bring the action. Now, if they bring an action and they lose, and they're subsequently able to prove, I think, that the plaintiff, that a defendant lied, then they refile the action, then of course they might be in a position at that
point.
Wouldn't
presumably refile the action. You'd file a motion under Rule 60B to reopen for fraud on the court.
Correct. And at that point, the action would still be part of an earlier live claim, and could then the litigation could then take a different course, which would be proof that the person lied. That didn't happen here. None of these plaintiffs originally brought an action within the time limit, and of course they have argued two different extraordinary circumstances, which is a basis for equitable tolling. In their opening brief, they argued that just what I mentioned before, which is that they had fared so poorly in their criminal cases that they believed that the, quote, political climate was unfavorable, and so that that led them not to file a claim. And we pointed out that, of course, the political climate didn't prevent them from filing a claim, which is a requirement for equitable tolling. So then they changed course.
Well, diligence is a requirement for equitable tolling.
That's another requirement as well, but so is being prevented. And then in their reply brief, they've changed their tune and have added a different extraordinary circumstance that they never raised during the entire course of this litigation. And that different one was they had psychological trauma that prevented them from bringing the action. But, of course, there is a body of case law that they completely ignore in their reply brief that limits the kind of psychological disability that circumscribes the kind of psychological disability that might allow a person to claim an extraordinary circumstance as a way around the statute of limitations. But the kind of allegations that they present in their assertions they present in the reply brief don't meet the standards of that established case law. Of course, they also argue the continuing violation doctrine, which is a way of delaying accrual of their claim. But this court has all their claims are discrete acts within the meaning of the Morgan decision. All of them were actionable on their own, didn't need to be joined with any other acts in order to be actionable on their own, were known immediately by each of the plaintiffs at the time they occurred, the torture, the race discrimination, the admission of the coerced confession at the trials, all those claims were immediately known. They were discrete acts, and this court has specifically held that discrete acts are not a basis for triggering application of the continuing violation doctrine, and so that doesn't help them either. If there are no further questions.
Apparently not. Thank you very much. Anything further, Mr. Henderson? You certainly have plenty of time.
Two brief points in response. Number one, Your Honor, they were not discrete acts in the context of the fact that if those were unrelated and had happened at the bottom of the food chain in the police department or in the state attorney's office.
Could you raise your voice a little?
Yes, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
No, those microphones don't amplify. You okay. Just need to. It's not the mics.
But you say they're not discrete acts, but the problem is, I think, for that position, if you look at Morgan, you know, that the acts of torture were not ambiguous. It wasn't like harassment where every day somebody comes in and says something offensive to you and sooner or later you just want to scream, you know, where it accumulates to the point where you now realize that there's a violation. It's immediately apparent to anybody who reads about what happened to these men that an actionable thing had occurred. It's no doubt about it.
Your Honor,
there may have been a lot of them, which is it's even more unfortunate, but it's not that any one of them was not obviously actionable.
Yes, but there's a presumption that's embedded in that statement or the question, which is that if you complain, then you will have access to justice. Mm-hmm. And just because something happens to you that's wrong and you're aware of it at the time doesn't mean that then you can go and seek redress in the court system. That's what they tried to do, and they were unsuccessful.
So Morgan doesn't say that. I mean, you're talking. I'm not saying Morgan precludes what you're saying, but it certainly doesn't address that kind of thing. Morgan.
Could one say after Morgan that this race discrimination occurred in a southern venue, and therefore the statute of limitations just never started to run because the victim of race discrimination predicted that juries would rule against him, and he wished to wait until a more enlightened age when juries might rule in his favor? Well, I think under Morgan that would defer indefinitely the start of the statute of limitations?
Well, I think the answer is yes and no. I think the answer is yes in the context of the fact that if there's no justice to be had, then the statute does get told. And that's really the issue. Justice is about doing the right thing. If the right thing, if the system doesn't do the right thing.
There's certainly no hint of that in Morgan.
No,
there isn't. The statute of limitations doesn't even accrue until the plaintiff is confident he can win.
And Morgan is not a systemic case because that's one person who works at a railroad and these things are happening to him over a period of time, whereas in this particular case, this is something that's happening at the highest levels of government. So it's a private employer or at least a semi-private employer because it's the railroad to one individual, whereas this case involves a multitude of people.
I don't see why it matters that the defendant are government employees.
Well, the high-level government employees.
Suppose, as was common in Title VII litigation, that racial discrimination was part of the employer's official policy. That this employer just didn't hire blacks. And so in January, black applicant applies and is turned down. In February, another one applies and is turned down, right? And so on. When does the statute of limitations start? On your view, the statute of limitations starts for all of them only when the last of them concludes that he can win a lawsuit.
No, the statute of limitations starts when you're able to get justice. If those things happened in the employment context and those people were complaining,
then
they're not able to get justice.
I don't understand why this isn't the same thing. Each incident of torture is actionable the instant it happens. It's a discrete act.
What's different is that you're presupposing in the employment situation where something wrong happens and then the person is able to go to court and get justice because the system is working. In this instance, something happened and the people were aware of it, but they were not able to go get justice. So the statute can't start to run until you're able to go to court and then get justice, and these people were not able to get justice because the system was broken.
Well, we had a long run under Title VII in southern states where it was very difficult to persuade white jurors to rule against employers. Has any court held that essentially abolished the statute of limitations for Title VII litigation?
Until
the applicants thought that they could win?
Just because the court hasn't ruled it doesn't mean that their lack of a ruling makes it right.
Mm.
So, and I give you, I'll close with one example, you know, which is a favorite one of mine, 1896 Plessy v. Ferguson, 1954 Board of Education. Nothing changed other than people's attitude towards the law. It was wrong in 1896 and it was wrong in 1954, but what changed was the justice's view of what should be done as opposed to the law itself. And in this particular situation, what we have is a systemic breakdown of the governmental system, the criminal justice system, from the police to the prosecutors and even including to the judges, which prevented the people that we represent from getting to court. And the test of justice at the end of the day is really how it treats the people who are on the outer margins and on the fringes, as opposed to the people who are squarely in the middle of being able to have their rights affected. And so these are people who were on the fringes and were not able to have their rights affected until we got to court. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Henderson. Thank you, Mr. Enriquez. We will take the case under advisement.